Welcome to the Time Bubble Podcast, the only podcast where the guests get to travel in time. I'm your host, Jason Ayres, and this week I'm joined by my fellow podcaster, Flora B. Welcome.
Hello, Jason. How are you?
Very good, yes. Just preparing for the heat wave that's coming our way, the red level emergency warning that we're all going to die. So
that's right.
So we'd better get this finished before we melt. Of course, by the time
the world explodes.
Before the world explodes, yeah. Of course, by the time this goes out in a couple of weeks, it'll probably be pouring with rain, and so this little conversation will seem completely redundant.
It will. Well, I hope it rains because I've just got an allotment, so I'm praying for some rain.
very good. So you've got a podcast as well. Tell us a little bit about it.
It's very new, very fledgling. I think I've done four now or three, I can't remember. It's called Sand in the Gears, and it's just really a way of having those conversations that you wish you could sit down and have with people. But
yes, well, I mean, I think the best podcasts perhaps are ones where people, you know, just do have conversations that flow freely, which is sort of what we intended to do with this. You can start with a loose idea and see where the conversation goes.
Yeah, it's just a nice way of chatting, I think. And then sometimes other people like to listen in on the conversation, don't they?
Yeah, and it's also a good way of keeping in touch with people. I mean, what I've enjoyed doing is, you know, just sitting down over Zoom and having a chat to someone that I might not necessarily have got round to talking to otherwise, because you know how life is, and if you got the kids and the job, and you can lose touch with people quite easily.
Yes, and this is where the technology can be used for good.
Yes, when the technology works properly, of course. Now we have had a few a few glitches this morning. We tried recording earlier, and we've had a bit of dropping out and that sort of thing. So I must apologise to everyone in advance if that does happen. Unfortunately, we don't have the multi-million budget of TV stations and such like to perfect this. So we've just got a free 40-minute Zoom call. So we are cheapskates, but we'll do our best. Okay, let's launch into the podcast then. We've done a few episodes of these now, and you've listened to some of them, Flora, so you know what to expect. We are going to talk about 3 days from your life that you would like to revisit. And after that, we're going to talk about some other places and times that you would like to go. So I'll ask the first question, which is, if you could go back to some time in your life, where would you go?
I think the first place I would go back to is a riverside and a field. I don't even remember where it was, but I was born and raised in the Midlands, in a big city in the Midlands, and we used to escape to the countryside quite a lot. And there was a big group of us. I had quite a bohemian upbringing. My dad was a musician and an artist, and so we knew lots of other musicians and artists. And this one weekend, it might have been a Sunday or Saturday, we all got together and had this massive picnic by the river. It was a hot sunny day. You know, one of those idyllic days that you remember?
Yes.
As idyllic as I remember it, but it was warm, it was sunny. There were loads of us children, and we were building rafts and floating down the river in these rafts. And as we were doing that, the rafts were disintegrating, but that was all part of the fun. And so the grown-ups were on the grass having a picnic, and we were all together in our swimming cozzies and shorts and pants, probably some of us.
Yes.
Building these rafts and splashing around in the river and climbing trees and just having the best time.
Just doing what we did. So how old would you have been, do you think, around that time?
Oh, do you know, I can't even really remember. Maybe seven
yeah.
or eight.
Yeah, I've got many similar memories from that age. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the summer of 1976, which people always talk about because it was the heatwave summer. And we lived in a village near the River Thames, and we used to go down there all the time. And like you say, there was, I think families were different, and there was always, you know, there was an uncle and granny would come and sit in the deck chair, and everybody seemed to do all these things together because we had so many of the family that lived in the village at the time. Whereas what I think what's happened now, perhaps it doesn't happen so much, is that families have scattered all over the country for various reasons. So you might not have these big get togethers in the same way.
Yeah, although it does seem to happen more with sort of friends these days. But I mean, I think about this, I just have this, the Led Zeppelin video that I can't remember, which has got a castle in it, and I'm sure there's a bit in it where someone is walking up the steps in this castle, and it's got that sort of freaky, top of the pops, psychedelic,
yes,
overlay on it. I've seen that, it just reminds me of that day.
Yeah.
Where the adults and the guitars and the singing and music being created and playing. I've just got that vision in my head, and I just think it was very Enid Blyton.
Yes, not a mobile phone in sight.
Oh, no, not a mobile phone in sight. Those were the days.
It's interesting the stuff you said about swimming in the river, because one of the bugbears I have about modern life is that anything that's enjoyable is jumped on by the health and safety police. Oh. And swimming in what they call it, wild swimming and such like, don't they, is really discouraged now. I mean, when we were that age, we used to go down to the Thames and go swimming in there all the time unaccompanied. I mean, maybe perhaps, you know, we think of that sort of level of freedom, it wouldn't be allowed now. But we got a nannying message from the school warning about all the dangers of the summer for the children, and it just went on and on over pages. And one section of it was about, on no circumstances ever go swimming in the river, it's dangerous, there's broken glass in there. And it said some rivers, if you got in, they've got steep banks and you might not be able to get out, and you'll get tired and you'll drown. And another thing it said was the water in British freshwater lakes and rivers never gets above 11 degrees C, even in midsummer, which is a complete lie, by the way. It's much warmer than that.
Yeah.
But it was this whole letter we got was just designed to stop the fun.
Don't have any fun. You
know, when you talk about, you know, your day that you mentioned there, it's such a contrast to how the modern world is.
I had a very free range child. They call it free range childhood now. I don't know. I was one of those children that was told, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, whenever it was. I was bought a watch for my, gosh, was it my seventh birthday? Well, no, it was Christmas. It was seventh Christmas, and shut out the door in the morning and told not to come back at tea time.
Yeah. it was very much like that, and I don't think it is now for many children.
I think it's the advent of cars. I think there are so many cars on the road now, aren't there,
that yeah,
more dangerous. I mean, when I was little, when I was a child, we would be playing in the road.
Yeah.
And there were very few cars around. I sound like I was born in the 1940s or something.
It does seem like another world. But, you know, you mentioned Enid Blyton earlier, and I remember devouring all those books when I was probably 8, 9, 10 years old. And even then, those books had been written probably, because, I mean, Enid Blyton died in about 1970, I think. Most of those books were sort of written in the 50s. Yeah. But the world of the 1970s was still quite relatable to the content of those books. I know that, you know, the Famous Five used to do that. You know, they would go off for the day to have their adventures. And I can't remember how old the children were in those books, but I'm guessing they were around sort of 10, 11 years old. That sort of appealed, didn't it? That world of freedom.
Yeah. And it felt like, I mean, I was a massive fan of Enid Blyton as well. And, I devoured all the books, The Famous Five, Secret Seven.
Yeah.
And I also grew up in one of the old Two Up, Two Down houses with an outside loo and no inside bathroom, outside loo, coal scuttle, coal shed, or what was it, concrete coal bunker, the outside. So I sort of feel that I dipped a toe in that very old world as well. And we moved there from there when I was 9. But I distinctly remember growing up in that house. So I could still, I sort of had a link to the past, if you like, from growing up in that kind of a house.
Yeah.
Heating and fireplaces in every room and fires in every room.
My grandparents' house was the same. And they had the outside toilet, which I remember used to freeze over in the winter, and the fireplaces and the coal bunker. And they used to keep chickens out the back and have a little, rather than having their own allotment, they had it all in their back garden. And of course, that's all gone now. When they died, the person that took over the house sold all the land behind for flats. And now it's just another modern house.
It's a bit heartbreaking, isn't it? I don't think I could go back and have a look because it would just be too sad.
It would. All right, that's a good one to kick off with. So have you got a second day to tell us about?
I do.
Okay.
how I say this one. I moved to Oxford in the summer of 1989.
Ah, well, I would have been around too because I'm born and bred there, and I was at college and working there at that time. So
yeah,
so I know it well.
Yeah, I wonder if our paths cross. You know, sometimes when I listen to you and London Raider and you talk about Oxford, I'm thinking, I wonder if our paths cross.
It's possible.
Yeah. So I moved to Oxford in 89, and I had no money, so I was busking for a living. And I moved into this little bedsit. I'd been travelling around France. I'd been busking around France, and then broke up with my boyfriend, moved to Oxford.
Yeah.
Put my guitar into town, and was busking in town.
Whereabouts in Oxford did you used to busk? Because I may well have walked past you.
In the Covered Market.
Oh, yeah, I love the Covered Market.
Yeah, in the Covered Market. That was my slot. Not in the centre.
No.
I can't remember which. Are they called avenues?
Yes.
Lanes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of those avenues or lanes. That was my spot. And I met other musicians through that. And I met other musicians really early on. There was this lovely girl. I won't mention her name just because I get in trouble.
Okay.
A violinist was just standing and listening and. Said, oh, come to the pub later, I'll introduce you to some more musicians. This was like within my first week or two. So I went off to, now was it the Blue Boar? Might have been the Blue Boar or the Bear or the Wheat Sheaf, one of those pubs.
The Wheat Sheaf had a big music scene at that time and they often used to have bands and stuff in there, so it could have been there.
They were just out the back having a pint. So I went to them, I went along with my guitar after busking, went in them. And anyway, that was my introduction to the Oxford music scene. And also the dance, the rave scene.
Yes, which was just getting going around that
time.
It
was just getting going. And I had just missed the Cassington, I think it was a Cassington rave.
Yeah, I lived about 2 miles from Cassington, so I think I remember that.
Yeah, well, they were all buzzing still about
this
thing. And so I started hanging around with these people, these ravers and musicians, and then I was asked one day if I fancied going on a picnic. So me being me, I was like, yeah, should I bring something? And they were like, no, a picnic.
Ah, that sort of picnic.
It was one of those sorts. It was a special picnic.
Yes. So
it was my very first time taking, I'm just going to call it E, I think, rather than into trouble by calling it everything else. And it was the time when white gloves were around. So I went on this picnic and we were all in the Lemon Flag. You know the Lemon Flag?
Oh, I love the Lemon Flag. It's gone now. It's closed, sadly.
Well, I read that it's supposed to be reopening.
Yeah, it's been a bit on and off. I signed a petition a while back to try and keep it open, but I don't know what the latest is, but I love that place.
Yeah, well, we were sort of hanging around there and we were all out the back. And I was given this little white thing and thought, goodness, this is, it looks like an aspirin.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was, well, let's just say it was, that really changed the course of my life, which sounds quite dramatic. But a summer of doing that just completely rewired my brain.
It opened your mind.
Yeah. It didn't just open my mind. My mind was fairly open.
Yeah.
But it really did rewire my brain. I was quite introverted, which sounds mad because if you're a musician, people think that you're extrovert. You know, there you are standing in front of people playing, but it's not like that. So I was quite an introvert, but it turned me into much more of a open, extroverted person. And there's lots of research being done now, isn't there, about how all of these different types of psychedelics like psilocybin and MDMA and all of that can really help with various sort of post-traumatic stress in,
yes,
in personnel. So there's lots of really interesting research being done now on how these things that were banned and seen as really awful can actually really help people.
Yes.
So I rewired my own brain in the 90s, I guess.
Yeah.
1999 in the 90s. And it was, I had the best time of my life. Yeah. 6 years of busking, meeting people, partying. It was just, yeah.
Our paths must have crossed because late 80s, early 90s years, I spent a lot of time socializing in Oxford and the places you mentioned and the music scene. I mean, there were places like the Jericho Tavern, which I'm sure mm-hmm. you probably played there. And do you remember the Dolly?
Yes, played at the Dolly.
You did play the Dolly. For anyone that it's I'm not sure what it is now. I think it might still be some sort of club.
Is it called the Purple Turtle? No.
Actually,
I think it's closed.
Yeah, has it closed?
There was a big campaign to keep it open, but I think the college, the university owned it.
It was, it was this underground, as I remember, you had to go underground on Oxford's main shopping street, and you go down there, and it was sort of, you could walk all around, couldn't you? And there was a stage area, and they would have a lot of heavy metal and rock stuff down there.
Yeah.
It was, I'd maybe call it sort of spit and sawdust. It was quite basic, wasn't it?
It was the very wooden basic floors. I think spit and sawdust, definitely.
But that was part of its charm. And it felt very sort of vibrant and rebellious down there. You felt that almost like it was somewhere you shouldn't be.
Yes. And I felt like that. Do you remember the Gloucester Arms?
Oh, yes.
The Biker Pub. I loved that place.
It was. That was very Biker Pub. And there was quite the gothic element used to get in there.
I was a goth. Well. Yeah. I was a goth. Before I started doing the ravey thing, or cyberpunk, I was a goth, yeah.
Yeah, well that's still there. I mean, I don't live in or around Oxford anymore, so I haven't been out drinking there. It's one of these things that I sometimes think, should I go stay for a weekend? But again, it's like, you know that all the best places are gone. And I know a lot of the pubs I used to drink in don't even exist anymore. And it did change, didn't it, during the 90s? I don't know if you remember that George Street started to get all these chain places like O'Neill's and All Bar One and all this and Weatherspoons. And that's not my thing at all.
No, it did start to change. I mean, I think the late 90s, the whole vibe changed because the drugs changed.
Yeah.
So you had these, I mean, like anything, you had bad people started to take advantage of that scene. When the drugs changed and got harder and nastier, everything just kind of, obviously people got older and sort of went on their own lives. So you can't really, I mean, some people carried on living that life.
Yes.
You can't do that all your life, can you?
Well, you have to ease off at some point because the body can't take it. I mean, it was more drinking than drugs with me. But when I think about the amount of alcohol I used to drink in the 90s, if I drank like that now, I you know, I probably wouldn't last.
Constitution's better, isn't it, when you're younger? You can really take some punishment when you're younger physically.
You can, and it's not the same now, but no. Okay, well, no, it's good to talk about Oxford because I have so many fond memories. So have you got a third day for us?
I do have a third day. And this was a day, this is on the other side of the world now. I went travelling around Southeast Asia in, when was it, 2001?
Okay.
The sort of over from November 2001 to around April 2002.
Right. Okay. And,
I had bought some snorkeling. I decided before I went that I was going to do a diving course. I was a really rubbish swimmer. I don't know what possessed me, but I decided I was going to spend lots of time in the water. And I bought a snorkel and a mask and all of that kind of thing. And I did a bit of traveling around Thailand to start with and ended up in Koh Tao, where I did a diving course. But before I started my course, I fixed all my snorkeling gear on and put my head down into the sea with my mask on, and this whole new world was there beneath the water. It was magical. It was just, I think, probably one of the most magical days.
So you've got all the different types of fish and flora, yes, and fauna under there. So
the colours were just, I mean, if anyone's ever been snorkeling in this country or gone underwater in this kind of place, it's all right, but you know, there are lots,
it's a bit murky,
brown things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was just like Technicolor. It's a little bit like, you know, The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
You know the song The Wizard of Oz, where it starts off in black and white, doesn't it?
And then it switches to colour.
And then it switches to colour.
Yeah.
It was like that. It was just like putting my head under the water and suddenly this whole world of colour, like psychedelic colour almost.
Yeah.
I'd only ever known fish to be brown or silver.
Yes.
And these were just...
So this was almost like an aquarium.
Yes. Yeah, if you can imagine the most colourful aquarium ever. It was like that. It was, and I was hooked.
Wow.
I was absolutely hooked. And as someone that didn't really swim, I just went, oh, and that was it. And it actually, snorkeling in Thailand was what taught me to swim. I sort of started swimming accidentally.
Yeah. Do you still do that now?
Not here.
There's not really many opportunities in the sewage-filled rivers of England.
Well, Kimmeridge is quite good. Kimmeridge in Dorset, Kimmeridge Bay.
Yes.
Clear sea. That's quite interesting as far as snorkeling or diving in the UK goes. But no, if you want colour, you have to go somewhere tropical.
Yeah, it's not something that I've ever really done, but it's one of those things that I'd like to do. Like many things in life,
I highly recommend it.
It's,
you know, when you do something, it's like going to Glastonbury for the first time. You know,
yeah,
first experience. You can never recreate that.
No, I mean, we
putting my head in the water for the first time and seeing that, I can never recreate that sense of magic. I literally took an intake of breath. It was just magical.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the sort of themes of the podcast, really, because by being able to go back to the actual day and relive that first experience again, you will hopefully still feel that experience because it will be as it was, like you say, about the first time going to Glastonbury or wherever. Whereas if you go back to the same place 20 years later, it's invariably a disappointment because it can never recapture how it was.
No, and I don't think you can recapture. I suppose so much time has passed now that I guess if I did that again, I would probably feel that same sense.
Yeah.
Of all. But yeah. I would have stayed in Thailand if I hadn't got friends and family over here. It was just beautiful. It's a lovely country, lovely people.
Yes. Moving on, we've got a couple of other questions to ask. And the next one is, if you could go anywhere in space or time, past, present or future, and step into someone else's shoes for a day, who would you choose?
I would be Gerald Burrell in Corfu between the two world wars.
So this would be around the time that he described in his book, My Family and Other Animals.
Yes, that's such a funny book. I love it. It's a great book, great read.
Yes, and it's been made into various TV series and film, I believe, as well.
Yeah, and the most recent one with Keely Hawes as Mrs. Turrell. She's fantastic in that. She's really good. I didn't like her in Ashes to Ashes.
No, I've seen her in quite a lot of things, but I haven't seen that one. I remember the one that they made in the 80s with Hannah Gordon.
I don't remember watching that, and I've sort of seen a couple just to compare. It's very different. I mean, the latest series with Keely Hawes in it is really good. I would recommend that. It's on Amazon Prime.
I shall look for that. So what appeals to you about the Corfu of the 1930s?
Oh, well, first of all, I'm a sun worshipper, so it's warm.
Yes.
I think the scenery, the sea, I'm a water baby as well. I love the ocean. I love the sea. It's why we moved down here to Devon rather than landlocked Oxford. And I think that era between the two world wars, even in this country, was a time of, there was like a lull, wasn't there?
Lull.
There was peace, there was hope. The landscape was very different. It hadn't been industrialised. Not to a great degree. Not what I call industrialisation now with all the roads and. And also the sense of wonder he had as a boy in his element.
Well, yeah, with all the wildlife that was on the album, because that's a strong feature of his work.
Yeah, and so his all of his first days as well, you know, if he could go back, all of those days where he would discover scorpions or spiders, or that sense of wonder that he had, discovering all these amazing new creatures in Corfu, and just those lazy days wandering around the island, chatting to the locals and just growing up somewhere like that. Must have been amazing.
And of course, it's in the days before mass tourism, which I would imagine if he could see parts of Corfu now, he would probably be horrified, because having travelled around, I went to quite a lot of Greek islands sort of in the early 90s and so on, and you could see the way that things were changing with the tourism. So I mean, Corfu is a good example. I flew into there when I was traveling around some of her islands, and I didn't get a very good impression from what I saw, because I only really saw the airport and one of the resorts. But then we took a boat over to one of the neighboring islands. I don't know if you've been there, called Paxos.
No, I've never been to the Greek islands.
No. Okay. Well, it was a very tiny place where tourism had hardly started, and it was very different to Corfu. There was only like two small villages on the island, and there was a small sort of square and a couple of bars where the tourism was just getting started. But if you wandered out sort of into the back of the village, you'd find these little places where somebody had got part of a cardboard box and just scrawled Taverna on it. And you'd wander in through this gate, and it would literally be like going into somebody's back garden, and there'd be a couple of tables in there. You know, there might be some chickens wandering about, and you'd sit down and someone would come out, and it would be, you know, their mum would be in the kitchen and they'd ask you what you want to eat, and then they'd be, you know, would you like my grandmother's homemade moussaka that, you know, she made today? And it literally was like going into someone's house and having them cook for you, and they'd have their own, you know, local wine, and it was quite an authentic experience, which I imagine what dining out would probably have been like before mass tourism. But then when I went back to Paxos about a decade later, and it had completely changed. It totally artificial beach built and barn everywhere. My memory of what that like had gone. And I think this is what it's like in a lot of the Greek islands now. So like I say, I think Gerald Durrell, if would be perhaps turning in his grave if he could see where some of the places he enjoyed in the 1930s, what they look like now.
He would be. I mean, I've read, I've got quite a thick biography of Gerald Durrell, and he, when he was alive, he went back a few times, and he actually, when he was in a boat going to his island, as he called it, he couldn't look in a particular direction because of all the tourism, all the buildings that had been built, and he had to kind of try and preserve this memory of the island as he saw it. So yeah, he saw it when it was being what he thought was ruined.
Yeah.
With things, yeah.
I'm sure there are places if you go off the beaten track. But of course many tourists have no interest in doing that. They want Benidorm in Greece.
They do. They want and chips.
Yeah. Well, that was there was a very memorable scene in Shirley Valentine. If you saw that, where
a long time ago, yeah,
she'd got a job in the cafe, and this English couple came in, and they were looking at the menu, and it had tarama salata and a squid, and what's this? Oh, I don't know. And she just said, "Do you want me to make you some egg and chips?" And they, "Oh, thank you." And they were all happy.
I don't see the point in going abroad. No. And to experience the country that you're visiting. You know, the people that go, they book like a package holiday to Turkey or somewhere, and they stay in the hotel and they eat the food in the hotel.
Yeah.
And they don't venture out of that complex.
It's the all-inclusive thing, which I don't agree with at all, because it's just no point. So
no. No, I couldn't bear an all-inclusive. I did one once many years ago to Tunisia, and it was awful.
Yeah. Same. Okay, well, we've got a few minutes left, so let's move on. Final question: if you could go anywhere in time, in history perhaps, and see what the world was like then, where would you go?
I would want to go back, I guess, around, it would be somewhere in Asia. It doesn't really matter what country, maybe India. I've got a bit of a fascination with India and Tibet. Before organized religion, so about 3,000 years ago, before those religions had been codified.
And yeah.
What I think of as stolen from the people. So I think Hinduism today is the closest that there is now to the old religion. And I've been reading, there's an author, he's Danish, called Aki Sinderberg.
Okay.
Is he Danish or was he Norwegian? I think he's Danish. He went travelling in India to, well, you know what people do then, they go off to find themselves.
Yes.
He went to India and got really involved in Hinduism, and realised that what they had there, this living religion of gods and goddesses, was what we had lost in the West.
Yes.
So going back and seeing what it was like, and then being able to translate that to our own country and our own old ways, I think it would be really, really fascinating. I was reading this book, I can't remember what it was called. It's actually about Scotland. It's about is it called Sea Window or something? There's a little throwaway line in this book that I was reading about this that bought us a little Scottish island. And it was something about the Druids in this country were connected to the Brahmins in India. And I thought it was like a little jewel within this passage that I was reading. And I went and researched it, and it turns out that, yes, the Druids in this country are related to the Hindus, the Brahmins of India. There's a connection there. So I think to be able to go back,
I think they were all very driven by cosmic influences, because when you look at, you know, Stonehenge and all these other things, that a lot of, they looked up at the stars and the heavenly bodies were very influenced by them. And of course, back in those days when you didn't have the light pollution that you have now, I mean,
you wouldn't
be able to see the stars from our garden, because we've got one of these great big horrible LED street lamps over.
Yeah.
But back then, with no artificial light, the night sky must have appeared brilliant.
It must have been their television.
Yeah.
Really? I just think it would have been amazing. I would love to go, and if I could travel around each of those countries like India and then Tibet, and just like I'm fascinated by the Tibetan Bon, although it was pronounced Bon, but it's spelled Bon, B-O-N, Tibetan Bon religion, which still does exist.
And to see what how the people lived. I mean, I was thinking
what their beliefs were.
Yeah, I think we'd have to have for this section of the podcast, when you go back, that you've got some automatic translation software in your head, so you
can
speak to them in their language of the time, so you get their beliefs. I always think it would be interesting to speak to people 3,000 years ago, because you know there's this, you'd say, oh, they'd all be primitive and such like, but I imagine they would probably be very similar to us.
I think, well, this would be a whole other podcast, but I think like Graham Hancock says, I think we're a species with amnesia. I think we had technology in the past that we don't understand now. I've come across this website called archaic.com, and you know the buildings in South America, these blocks that are very curvy and they all fit together, and they say you can't fit a cigarette paper.
Yeah.
Somebody posted it, I think it was on Twitter actually a week ago, a corn cob, and how kernels sat in this corn cob, not one of our modern ones, in linear rows, but this old corn cob from South America. And it mirrors all the buildings, that those stones, those blocks mirror how those kernels of corn sit within this ancient cob of corn. But they still can grow it. So there's multicoloured ones. It's got like red corn and yellow corn in this same cob.
Yeah.
And there's this website called archaics.com, and he has discovered, I haven't managed to read it myself yet, I've heard it on another podcast, Max Eigen's podcast, Crow House.
Yes.
And he has come across something called geopolymer, which allowed the South Americans to mould stone, which could explain why they've got this very curvy, all different sizes and all different curvy shapes that they've managed to build.
Yeah.
Structures.
It's fascinating stuff. I'd just say before we go, to recommend that people come and listen to your Sand in the Gears podcast, because I know the one you did with Michael Livesley, you talked a lot about these sort of spiritual issues, which I found fascinating.
I'm completely into all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in quite a big way.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, look, thank you for coming to join me today. It's been a really fascinating chat, as it always is, and I hope you enjoyed it.
I did.
Okay.
Thank you so much for asking.
You're very welcome, and I'll be coming on your podcast sometime soon too. So
you will be. Yes, we'll have to plan. We'll plan a proper date for that.
We will. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and bye bye, and see you again soon.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.